It seems to me that the politics of it is both extraordinarily complex and also without precedent. So there is very little to fall back on as an example of how this might have played out in the past. So the complexity, there are lots of different ways you can describe the complexity, but it seems to me that there are at least five dynamics which could prove decisive, as it were, five political contests or standoffs which could prove decisive. There is, and Charles mentioned this yesterday, there is the law courts versus the politicians. There is the Commons versus the Lords. There is the executive versus the legislature. There is direct democracy versus representative democracy. And there is a contest between the constituent parts of the United Kingdom, which we'll describe for shorthand as England versus Scotland, which Charles didn't mention at all yesterday. Now, I think any of those could be decisive, which is why it's so complicated. So for the interest of time, I'm just going to state my view on this. I think the first two are unlikely to be decisive. So again, Charles Clarke said yesterday he thought that the legal case was fairly convincing for the necessity of a parliamentary vote early on in the process, that this would arrive at the Supreme Court in due course. I just want to say one thing, which is nothing to do, I'm aware of the building we're in, this is absolutely not my area of expertise, so this is just an observation about political psychology. I think the members of the Supreme Court will be extremely nervous about being seen to be the decisive actors in this process, not least because the Supreme Court is a relatively young body. I know it happens in the United States, but it took time. And an issue of this complexity and contentiousness, it would be politically extremely challenging, I think, for that contest to be decisive. And I think the same is true of the Commons versus the Lords. Again, as we heard yesterday, there is clearly within the House of Lords a large majority of members who would like to undo or reverse or at least put barriers in the way of Brexit. But the House of Lords cannot be decisive in this. Charles Clarke said yesterday that the great thing about the members of the House of Lords is that they don't give a toss about what other people think. Well, fine, but unfortunately for that very reason, questions of democratic legitimacy will arrive very soon. So if I completely believe it's possible that the courts or the Lords could put serious barriers in the way of this process, but when that happens, the process then would revert to some democratic forum in which that contest would have to be resolved. So it would, if it gets stuck there, it moves from there. So where does it move? Well, presumably back to the Commons. So I think the other three are more likely to be decisive. So you've got the executive versus the legislature. And again, it is clear, I mean, the executive is divided, the cabinet is divided, but the cabinet is also bound by collective responsibility, and it seems to have, there may be resignations. We keep hearing rumours about Philip Hammond, but it seems unlikely that there will be a fundamental cabinet split, which does divide the cabinet. The cabinet will pursue Brexit from the legislature, in which there is, if there was a free vote, a majority of Remainers. I just want to raise something that was not said yesterday, because this is not happening. Brexit is not an isolated incident. British politics is febrile enough as it is without Brexit. Two remarkable things have happened in the last 18 months, unprecedented things in British politics. Brexit is one, but the election of Jeremy Corbyn is the other. And the election of Jeremy Corbyn is now just a fact of life, a feature of the political landscape. We forget. It's completely extraordinary. And Charles Clarke said yesterday that the Labour Party is getting its act together, and a lot of people are pinning huge hopes on Keir Starmer, which is fine. But I think the other way to look at it is that the four leading positions in the Labour shadow cabinet are currently held by Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell, Emily Thornberry, and Diane Abbott. And if you were told 18 months ago that that was the case, you would conclude that the Labour Party had ceased to exist, or at least it had become some bizarre rump of North London MPs. There is no alternative government in this country. I know this is a contentious point of view, but I think it is a fact of political life. And I'm not just basing this on the polling that puts them 80 points ahead. Anything can happen in politics, and you never say never, but it is an unprecedented situation that the main party or opposition, not just the divisions within that party, does not seem to me, and it is clear already there, and again, we heard a bit about it yesterday, that it's induced a kind of hubris in the Conservative Party. But they can be as hubristic as they like. It doesn't change the facts that I do not see that the Labour Party, though they may put up serious parliamentary opposition to the Brexit process, at the bottom of the British Constitution is the requirement that there is an alternative government in waiting. And I genuinely do not think that there is. Others may disagree about that. And some of the polling is stark. I'll just give you one piece of polling, which is that among the most recent poll I saw, I think it's from 2 weeks ago, among voters aged 75 and over, which is a very significant voting block, not least because they vote more than people aged 18 to 24, and it's a large number of people, Theresa May's lead over Jeremy Corbyn is 70-7, with 63 points. This is unprecedented in what is still a two-party state. So I think that does fundamentally change the dynamic. So it's internal Tory party politics rather than government opposition, which is decisive. And the Tory party, though it's very good at getting rid of prime ministers and many other things, is still a relatively disciplined body. So I think one needs to be careful about putting too many hopes on this. It's important not to forget the fundamental fact, which is that the opposition, whatever you might think about the performance of particular ministers at particular times, is in an unprecedented state of disarray. And it's only going to get worse, not least the boundary changes are going to make Labour's internal difficulties worse. So this is a government operating, I feel, without, at the fundamental level, a plausible alternative government. The question of representative democracy versus direct democracy. So Theresa Mandate is claiming, Theresa Mandate, Theresa May. Theresa Mandate is claiming the May of the, you know what I mean? She's claiming the mandate of the referendum. And again, I agree with Charles Clarke. Her conference speech indicated that she was interpreting it very broadly to mandate her to do a range of things. It's a political philosophy she's trying to build on it. It's one vote, it's one referendum, it's not binding. This is still a parliamentary democracy. And presumably at some point, the key test of this, and this is why the absence of a plausible alternative government is so important, will be a general election. I think another feature of British political life that is not discussed enough is the existence of the 5-year Fixed-Term Parliament Act, which is now law. It was an act of convenience. It simply was brought into law to enable the coalition to exist. It doesn't have any other function. But it did not fall into abeyance when the coalition... and it completely changes the dynamics of British politics. And the best illustration of that is, if that legislation were not in place, if that were not law, the chances of the next general election being in 2020 would be zero. Because previous to that, no politician, no prime minister ever went the full 5 terms unless they had no choice. John Major, Gordon Brown. It's like putting loser across your forehead to run a full 5-year term. And the pressure for an election would be overwhelming. Maybe not this year, maybe next. Whereas I now think that, as Charles Potts said yesterday, it's still by far the likeliest date for the next election, 2020. One of the reasons for that is that people say if they need to have an election, they will have one, they'll either repeal it or they'll find a way around it. But it's not at all clear how you do that. And one of the complications is that one reason that there may need to be an election is that the government, the executive, loses control of the Commons. But if the government loses control of the Commons, it still needs the Commons to agree to an election. And it becomes very complicated. So I think it's still more likely than not that the next election will be in 2020. And that's the reason why. And then finally, and then I'm going to also say for a couple of minutes things that I think connect some of these disparate themes. And then finally, there is, which Charles Clarke didn't mention at all yesterday, the question of the real opposition to this government, which is the SNP, and the possibility of there being another referendum. There won't be another referendum on Brexit, but there may well be. The moves are underway. Nicola Sturgeon would like us to believe that she is planning for a second independence referendum. And that is an exceptionally complicated, high-stakes dynamic. She is essentially calling Theresa May's bluff. Theresa May might call her bluff because I don't think Nicola Sturgeon wants a second referendum because I think she would lose it. And again, I think the reason she would lose it is not itself to do with Brexit, but there are fundamental facts about British politics that undercut that. And one of those is that the currency question has got more, not less, complicated. There is not a majority in any parts of the United Kingdom for anyone to join the euro. But in the absence of that, this becomes a very, very difficult. And this is, I think that's the most high stakes politics in all of this, because Nicola Sturgeon is not just, as it were, an effective opposition. She is herself a leader of a party of government. And that to me, and I say it partly because Charles Scott didn't mention it at all, that to me is in some senses the central dynamic here, but it is a high stakes game of bluff. That is an incredibly complicated five set of things to interact with each other. So I then want to just say a few general remarks about some things that connect them. So one of which just comes out of that, which is this thing Brexit has happened at a point where Britain's unwritten but real constitution is in itself a fragile state. So if you just take some of those elements, the five-year fixed-term Parliament Act, the existence now of the Supreme Court, but a relatively new and untried, in political terms, untried institution. I mean, what is its political mandate? What is its legitimacy? Devolution and the complexities of devolution, essentially the unresolved question, not just of Scotland, but of England. I mean, England versus Scotland is asymmetric warfare because England is bigger, so it's asymmetric one way, but England has no representative institutions of any kind. Of any kind. There is no English, who speaks for England? So that is unresolved. So Brexit has happened against the backdrop of real, I think, fragility or uncertainty in Britain's constitutional arrangements, and Brexit will no doubt resolve some of these questions, or if not resolve them, drive them hard. But that's what adds to the complexity. I think, so Charles Clarke said yesterday, the key thing here is timing, that these things will look different over time. So some of the political dynamics will look different over time, and I think that's true. I just want to say a couple of things about timing. So one, which is something that just really struck me in the last couple of days, which is that I believe, I mean, you never know, so I believe it's understood that the government is offering the Commons a vote on the deal, but at the end of the process, is that right? That's the latest position. And that the Commons will be entitled to reject the deal, but the understanding is the Commons won't be able to undo Brexit because Brexit will be a fait accompli. So the choice the Commons is being given is Brexit with the deal or Brexit with no deal. So what this reminds me of strategically, and I think this is an important analogy, I'm not making a polemical point here, this was the Blair government strategy in the Iraq war. So there was a really complex related question, which is Parliament's role in approving war. And the Blair government strategy in the Iraq war was to have a series of Commons debates on the war, in which it was always said it's too soon for a vote, because we don't know what we're voting on. And then the vote came when the British troops were massed on the borders of Iraq, and the Americans were going to invade in days anyway, and Blair was able to get up in the Commons and say, you are entitled now to vote this thing down, but the war's going to happen anyway. And if you do vote it down, you're voting it down at a point where it will hand Saddam Hussein a victory. And that seems to me to be the tactic. And it was incredibly effective parliamentary politics, and it was catastrophic for the British state. The second thing is that Charles Clarke said yesterday that over time, as the economic effects kick in, the Remainers will find their voice. I mean, effectively, that they will gain confidence. At the moment, it's very hard to make the case against the will of the people. More people voted for Brexit than have ever voted for anything else. It's very hard to make the case for the will of the against the will of the people. But as people come to feel the economic consequences, which will play out over one, two, three, four years, it will embolden opposition, particularly in Parliament. So time is on the side of the Remainers. That may be true, but time is also against them, because other things will happen, and again, we heard a bit about it yesterday, in Europe. So the next big event is the Italian referendum. That's the next big political event. So if Renzi loses that, who knows what follows? A general election in Italy, a new government in Italy, Beppe Grillo, who knows? So the other thing that could happen over time, one shouldn't just assume that what will happen is Britain will feel the pain of Brexit, and therefore people will wish they hadn't voted for it. If things go wrong in Europe, people will think, thank God we don't belong to that lot. And those two things will play out alongside each other. So the politics is that interlocking dynamic, and the timing thing is very, very hard to fathom. I think it's very, very unpredictable. And it will be this sort of, it's contingent on very small moments of timing, which thing happens first. But if there is another full-blown crisis of the euro, I don't think it's going to make the British people regret that they chose to leave the European Union. Even if we're feeling the economic pain, and of course it gives something to blame the economic pain on. I mean, this is politics, it's not anything else. And then the last thing is that this is politics, never stops. There's a by-election in Witney today. The Tories are going to win it, but say they don't. Say the Liberal Democrats win the Witney by-election. This dynamic looks different. It looks seriously different 24 hours from now. I think it's very unlikely. I think it's kind of know, the betting markets can't be trusted because they got Brexit won, but it's at best a 10% chance, just as Donald Trump is at the moment a 10% chance. And the thing about 10% chances is they don't never happen. They happen roughly one in every 10 times. So there are going to be a lot of those events, and one in every 10 of them at least. It's a shame you can't run these things as experiments. It'd be very interesting to know what a Liberal Democrat victory in Whitney does to the political dynamics of Brexit. Thank you. That's it.